published this book entitled You Have to Be Prepared to Die Before You Can Begin to Live, 10 Weeks in Birmingham That Changed America. This just came out in May of this year. Those 10 weeks in Birmingham, Alabama, in the spring of 1963 was an incredible year in the United States and in the South and in Birmingham, Alabama. And we're now approaching the 60th anniversary of an event that took place on September 15th, 1963, beyond after the chronological scope of your book, September 15th, the bombing of the 16th Street Baptist Church, 19 sticks of dynamite, 20 people injured, and 4 little girls killed. Carol Denise McNair was 11, Addie Mae Collins, Carol Rosamond Robertson, and Cynthia Dion Wesley were 14. These 4 little girls were killed. I'd like to talk more about that event with you. It fell outside the scope of your book, per se, but we're going to talk about that in a moment. But Birmingham, like Birmingham, Alabama, Martin Luther King referred to Birmingham, Alabama as, quote, probably the most thoroughly segregated city in the United States. Talk about Birmingham, Alabama for me, Paul Kix. Talk about what Birmingham, Alabama was like as a city back in the spring and the fall and the winter throughout the year of 1963.
Yeah. Throughout the year of 1963, yeah. Birmingham was a place that was known even by public officials as Bombingham. It was a place where more than 50 bombings set forth by the Ku Klux Klan and very likely the Birmingham Police Department working alongside them. They bombed various prominent Black residences, prominent Black businesses. All of those bombings went unsolved. They went unsolved in some measure because the Birmingham police force was overseen by a public safety commissioner by the name of Eugene Bull Connor, who is one of the most vile creatures to ever emerge out of any period of history and now any history book. Birmingham was a place where the Klan castrated Black men as a way to try to intimidate civil rights leaders. Birmingham was a place where the police department raped Black women in their patrol cars. Birmingham was a place where CBS's Edward R. Murrow, who went to the city just prior to King's arrival there, he said to his producer when he left town, producing a story just on Birmingham and what it was like, Murrow said, "I have not seen any place like this since Nazi Germany." That's Birmingham, Alabama in 1963.
And you mentioned the fact that it was referred to as Bombingham. Lots of businesses bombed and homes bombed and churches bombed. All sorts of churches got bombed.
Yeah.
Burned down and bombed.
Yeah. So one of the main characters of the book, in fact, the character who inspired the title is a quote from the Reverend Fred Shuttlesworth, who perhaps for your audience, I think Fred Shuttlesworth should be as well-remembered as King. In fact, I would argue that he's probably a more courageous man than even King himself. Fred Shuttlesworth was very often the lone civil rights activist in Birmingham before King and everybody else arrived. And for his actions, his parsonage was bombed. He was beaten nearly to death on multiple occasions. He stepped in front of a moving bus that refused to integrate in Birmingham. And when people, prominently New Yorkers with whom Fred was trying to raise money for those 10 weeks, when they asked him, "How is it that you've sort of maintained this life? Why are you still in Birmingham? What is your reason for being?" And he said, "Well, you have to be prepared to die before you can begin to live." And for Fred, that meant a quite literal preparation for death. But because of who he was as a pastor at Bethel Baptist Church in North Birmingham, there can be read into that statement a metaphoric implication. I think it's this. I think that Fred was talking about resurrection. And there is a Christian connotation to that, absolutely, but I think there is one that's even deeper than that. I think there's one that's applicable to everybody, regardless of their religious beliefs or non-beliefs. And what Fred is talking about there is really everybody's need to move beyond who they are as a person, to move beyond what is comfortable, what is familiar, even if it's unsafe. And often it was in the Deep South, if you were a Black person in the 1960s, to move beyond that which was comfortable and to embrace fully a life that was your calling. That's the life of the higher purpose, as Ralph Waldo Emerson once put it. We have to move beyond what is familiar, beyond what is safe. We have to shed that former self so that we might fully live.
Tell me about those 10 weeks, Paul.
The 10 weeks are from March of 1963 until early June of 1963. And those 10 weeks are known as Project Confrontation. And the idea is they will go to Birmingham, the very site of domestic terror, white terror, you might say, and anger every terrible white person there.
Who's they?
The SCLC, the Southern Christian Leadership Conference. These activists, and there are four protagonists in this book. One of them is King. One of them is Shuttlesworth, who already had a civil rights organization there in Birmingham, but he joined forces with the SCLC. And the other two I focus on are Wyatt Walker, who was executive director of the SCLC, and then also James Bevel, who was sort of the operations lead. Those are the four protagonists of this book.
Tell me about the Birmingham campaign.
That campaign is one where the idea is they will turn their bodies into vessels of suffering. Because if they can turn their bodies into vessels of suffering, then perhaps the New York Times reporter who's taking notes, or the camera crew who's going to be sending footage back to Walter Cronkite for the evening news, perhaps that suffering will find a way to influence the America, and really the two people in America who matter most, Jack and Bobby Kennedy sitting at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue, who had to that point in time wanted absolutely nothing to do with the civil rights movement. The stakes were enormous. They knew that if they went down there, they might very likely die. They knew that if they went down there, they might very likely not survive as an organization. They knew as well that what they hoped to do, which was to influence Jack and Bobby Kennedy to author civil rights legislation, they knew that that was just as much as a long shot, and yet they did it all anyway.
So tell me about the campaign. Get into the details, Paul. There was the Children's Crusade. There was voter registration. The first public school in Birmingham was integrated, if I understand correctly, on September 4th, which is outside the scope of those 10 weeks. But tell me about the nuts and bolts of that campaign. What went on? What did those four people and their comrades in Birmingham, supporters in Birmingham, do?
At first, the campaign was one that they thought they would have a lot of Black Birminghamian adults to participate. That turned out not to be the case at all. Almost nobody wanted to protest alongside the SCLC. And so for the first month of the campaign, it was an abysmal failure. The SCLC believed that they would fail as largely as they had failed in any campaign prior. And by the way, they had had nothing but failure in every campaign prior. They really thought that this would be their last campaign. And almost as a last-ditch attempt within Birmingham, James Bevel says, well, there's one constituency in Birmingham who perhaps will protest alongside us. And the main reason the adults wouldn't was because they knew that if they did, they would lose their jobs. And Bevel said to King, there's one group of people who don't have to worry about holding jobs, and those are children. And King wanted absolutely nothing to do with this. We mentioned just a minute ago about what Edward R. Murrow said about Birmingham, right? King believed the same thing. He thought he was going to die for going to Birmingham. So the last thing he wanted to do was put children on the front lines. And yet day by day and ultimately week by week, Bevel was able to convince the rest of the SCLC that no, children are our only option. And so in early May, there was the campaign built to a crescendo that was known as D-Day and Double D-Day. And the idea was if they could fill the jails, then perhaps they could break the segregation of Birmingham. Perhaps they could get officials like Bull Connor to actually want to integrate the city. Because if they could fill the jails, then there would be nowhere else to put these protesters. The other idea was if they filled the jails and Bull still decided to try to maintain his foothold within Birmingham and maintain segregation, that meant one thing would happen. And that one thing was violence. So on May 2nd, 1963, more than 1,000 kids go out, and they go into Kelly Ingram Park in Birmingham, exiting from 16th Street Baptist Church. There's a metaphoric significance of 16th Street Baptist. That is where almost all of the protesting originated from in that spring. So the kids come out of 16th Street Baptist, and over 1,000 are arrested that day, arrested peacefully. And as a result of that, there's perhaps 5,000 more who come back on Double D-Day. Well, now Bull Connor is faced with a dilemma. The jails are full. He does not have room for 5,000 more protesters. He can either begin to negotiate with King, or he can turn his sort of vengeance upon the kids, which is the bet that the SCLC made, and which is exactly what happened. And what happened that day, kids thrashed about by German shepherds, kids openly feasted on by these dogs.
How old were these kids?
Some as young as 10. There were kids who protested that day as young as 4. Most of them were teenagers. They ranged in age from 4 to 18. Kids who were hit with fire hoses. Those fire hoses could dislodge mortar from brick. Those fire hoses could strip bark from trees at a distance of more than 100 feet. They hit children, those fire hoses, at less than 30 feet. The kids described that day their clothes disintegrating. In fact, you can see it in some of the raw footage that almost no documentary has ever shown. It would tear out hair. It effectively scalped kids. The sort of burns from the water itself. These images were what Jack and Bobby Kennedy saw.
And these were all on television.
Yep. It led the news. These images were so powerful that NBC News would ultimately expand its nightly news from 15 minutes to 30 because of what happened on Double D-Day. These images were so powerful that when some of the still images appeared the next day in the New York Times, Jack Kennedy said that they made him sick. And it was the first time that Jack began to think, what if we actually authored a civil rights bill? And he would continue to fight it for about a month more. But this is the ultimate position that the Kennedy brothers took.
And so, okay, there was the children's crusade in the course of those 10 weeks. But thereafter, there were also massive efforts at registering black voters, because black voters were completely disenfranchised back then. They could not vote.
The voter registration campaign was one that didn't necessarily take place within these 10 weeks. And that's in large part because King didn't feel that having a voter registration drive would make much sense if the people who would register to vote still dealt with unbearable inequality. And so within those 10 weeks, there wasn't a huge effort within Birmingham to register voters. There were small pockets where that happened, but by and large, the SCLC's efforts were one to see if they could actually desegregate the most segregated and violent place in America. And they thought if they could do that, then perhaps the voting of rights that they wanted would take place not only across Birmingham, but across the nation. Because Birmingham was really a metaphor, right? Birmingham was the most awful place in America. And King and Shuttlesworth and Wyatt Walker and James Bevel felt that if they could integrate the most racist, the most violent place in America, then that meant that segregation itself would fall. Because just the story of Birmingham integrating would force other cities to integrate as well. Almost the entire campaign was one of sort of unbelievable bravery, people facing down nightsticks, people facing down incredible violence. It was also one of an almost psychological warfare. It was the SCLC engaging in sort of psychological tactics with the Birmingham establishment to try to get what they wanted from that establishment that did not want to give it to them. And so they ended up using Birmingham's power against itself to obtain what the SCLC wanted.
So concretely, what else, what other activities, what other actions did they engage in concretely?
There were smaller campaigns to get out the word of the violence that Birmingham could wreak upon the public. There were numerous efforts to get more and more first Black children and Black adults to protest alongside them. There were efforts to almost entice Bull Connor to act in the way that they knew, the SCLC knew that he wanted to. And so some of this was a means to try to get Bull to respond in such a way so that the press would pick up more and more coverage of this. You know, there's an anecdote that I like actually from Selma the next year, which is also applicable to how the SCLC viewed its actions with respect to the press and activists. So there is this activist who was beaten bloody. I don't know if he was beaten nearly to death, but he was beaten absolutely bloody. And there was a photographer from Life magazine who tried to help up this man. And King was nearby and he rushed up to the Life photographer and he said, "Don't you ever do that again." And the Life photographer was like, "What?" And King said, "Your job is to shoot this. Your job, in other words, is to show this to the world. Your job is not to help us. We can help ourselves. If you want to help the cause, then what you can do is show the world the barbarity that the South carries out almost every day." And that was part of the sort of calloused tactics that the SCLC used in Birmingham. These are men of faith, and it was very difficult for some of them to have to agree to this, but they knew this was the only way for it to work.
So, okay, these 10 weeks in the spring of 1963, in August of 1963 is the March on Washington. It's like 60 years ago. September 4th, 1963, the first school, public school in Birmingham is desegregated. And then on September 15th, these 19 sticks of dynamite go off at the 16th Street Baptist Church in Birmingham, killing these four girls and injuring 20. What can you tell me about that event?
I think we're forgetting perhaps one very important detail prior to that, which is, as a result of what happened in that spring, Jack and Bobby Kennedy ultimately agree with King that civil rights legislation is necessary. And so on June 11th, 1963, Jack Kennedy delivers a primetime address in which he says, "I am sponsoring civil rights legislation." Nobody in his cabinet wanted him to do it. They thought he would lose the 64 election for doing it. But he and Bobby alone within the cabinet thought that this was the right decision. And it was all because of Birmingham. They said, "But for Birmingham, we would not be here today." Throughout that summer, the introduction of the Civil Rights Bill, the integration of the first school, this angers a tremendous amount of white people within Birmingham and in large part the Birmingham establishment, everybody who still held power in some way.
And the KKK.
Yes. Bull Connor was thrown out of office over the summer, too, as a result of King and everything begins to change. And when things begin to change, people begin to revolt against that change. And the bombing of the 16th Street Baptist Church in the fall of 1963 has arguably almost everything to do with what happened in the spring of 1963.
And this was, well, strictly speaking, the very late summer, just before fall, September 15th, 1963. What can you tell listeners about that event?
A lot of the kids who protested that spring belonged to 16th Street Baptist or had friends that went there. Birmingham was a very sort of villagey, neighborhoody based city. And so a lot of times your world, whether you were Black or white, would be your school and your church and maybe a few other neighborhood blocks. 16th Street Baptist was one of those main churches within Black Birmingham. And the bombing there affected, of course, everybody. And what I can tell you is 60 years later, some of the kids who protested, when I've spoken with them or where they've talked about it in oral histories, always bookend those conversations of the spring with the incredible sadness they feel about what happened in that fall.
And very shortly thereafter, I mean, I just want to, you know, repeat the names of these girls. Carol Denise McNair was 11. Addie Mae Collins, Carol Rosamond Robertson, and Cynthia Dion Wesley were 14. They were, I was just reading about this. The damage their bodies suffered was grievous. They were apparently thrown across the basement like rag dolls. The sermon that was about to be red was upstairs in the church was a rock that will not roll. And just moments before that sermon, the bomb went off and they were grievously injured and killed. And a number of other kids were, you know, severely injured as well. And the FBI came in to town. They sent like, I don't know, a dozen of their agents or more. And they knew, you know, within a couple of years, they had established the FBI Klan involvement in the bombing. In 1965, they formally established who was involved from the Klan. There were four of these guys. But it would not be until 12 years later, 1977, that Robert Chambliss, who was found guilty of the death of Carol McNair, was sentenced to life in prison. And Bobby Frank Cherry and Thomas Blanton were indicted in 2000.
I don't find that all that remarkable because you still see this happening today. Let's go back to Rodney King. How many of those officers were convicted? The almost incredible thing about George Floyd was that with video proof, George Floyd was one of the first time that the officer was found, was convicted. Now, with respect to the bombing, the FBI had to investigate this because the Birmingham Klan and the Birmingham Police Department were in many ways inseparable. So the FBI had to come down there to do that. That it took so long. The remarkable thing to me is that they were even convicted because for so long they hadn't been. Part of the reason that they went to Birmingham, the SCLC, was because of the 100 years from 1863 to 1963. In 1863, the Emancipation Proclamation is signed. But from 1863 to 1963, effectively nothing changes. Black people are still second-class citizens, if not worse. For decades, Black people were lynched publicly, and no person who killed an innocent Black man was ever, by a court in the South or the North, held accountable for their actions. So again, the remarkable thing to me is that as a result of what happens in Birmingham in 1963, a decade later, you begin to see the first vestiges of justice carried out against the people who actually perpetrated that crime. That's the remarkable thing.
Last question, Paul Kicks. Is this sort of stuff taught in American schools today? And I know that American politicians, the governor of Florida and the governor of Texas, and I'm sure there are other ones, don't want this kind of stuff to be presented to kids in schools. Books are banned. You know, Black history is censored. American Black history.
Yeah. So I grew up in Iowa and I did some readings in Des Moines. And when I was there after one reading, an English teacher, I believed, high school English teacher approached me and he said, I loved your book. I could not teach this. And I said, why? There was a law that was passed last year by the Iowa legislature that basically says that any book that deals with racial suppression, racial injustice, it runs the risk of being banned by the school. And he said to me, this teacher, I run the risk of losing my job for teaching a book like this. And it just floored me that this is what America has come to. And I see, broadly speaking, a real sort of rolling back of freedom of expression, both on the right with the book bans and on the far left with a lot of the cancel culture stuff. And I think that I hope that America can emerge out of this period. I believe it will. But it's incredibly frustrating to encounter a reader like that who says, I couldn't present this to my kids.
I'd like to thank you so much for joining me on the Green Planet Monitor.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you, David. I've appreciated it.
Paul Kicks is an American journalist and author. His new book, You Have to Be Prepared to Die Before You Can Begin to Live, 10 Weeks in Birmingham That Changed America, has just been published. Read more about the Birmingham campaign, Birmingham Sunday, and Paul Kicks' new book at greenplanetmonitor.net. That's that's it for today's GPM, a listener-supported podcast coming to you from Earth Chronicle Productions in the Netherlands. Listen, read, and watch more Earth stories at greenplanetmonitor.net. Find us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and YouTube, and our home base, Blueberry. We're also on Facebook and Twitter, and the Harbinger Media Network. Wherever or however you're listening, reading, or watching, please help us make the GPM happen. Subscribe and or donate at greenplanetmonitor.net. By the way, the guy behind this guitar is Dan Weisenberger. Thanks for your brilliant instrumental themes, Dan. I'm David Kattenberg. Over and out for now.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. Since 2019, more than 600 gray whales have washed ashore along the West Coast, from Mexico to Alaska. Occasional strandings occur every year, but these numbers are far higher than normal, and some of the whales were abnormally thin.
We set about to really try to look at what was going on with their food source.
Sue Moore of the University of Washington says gray whales do most of their feeding in the Arctic during the summer. They primarily eat small arthropods that live on the ocean floor. But in some areas, these bottom-dwelling animals are declining, and the mix of species is shifting. Moore says those changes are partly driven by the changing climate. Melting sea ice speeds up Arctic ocean currents, which limit the ability of some arthropods to build homes in the sediment. Melting ice also affects the growth of algae, which these creatures need for food. In some areas, Moore says whales are turning to other sources of food, such as krill.
But it's very hard to be definitive about how that could cause a mortality event.
So she says more research is needed, but it appears that even this large, powerful mammal faces challenges adapting to the warming world.
Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To hear more stories like this, visit climateconnections.org.
You are now listening to CJSF 90.1 FM. broadcasting from Burnaby, BC.